More from Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. If most of us know anything at all about Grover Cleveland, it's that he was the one U.S. president to serve two non-consecutive terms in office. But Cleveland's presidency was remarkable for reasons beyond that one piece of trivia. He was in office during a financial crisis and political fracturing eerily reminiscent of what the country is going through today. But the Cleveland administration was also responsible for a little-known cover-up that, were it to occur today, would make the Anthony Weiner scandal seem like a quaint sidebar. It was a cover-up that has gotten little attention since the early part of the 20th century, until now. It's the subject of a new book by historian and public radio producer Matthew Algio, called The President is a Sick Man. Algio spoke with Mitch Tyke recently and filled in the substantial gaps in our knowledge of Cleveland and his presidency.
Yeah, Grover is the president who messes up the numbering for the presidents. He was the 22nd and 24th presidents. In fact, when President Obama gave his inaugural address in January 2009, he said 44 people have now taken this oath. And I was at a little party. Everybody was watching. I said, no, actually 43 people have taken the oath because Grover is counted twice. And when you think about that, too, that's an amazing accomplishment in American politics. It's a unique accomplishment, really, in American presidential politics to lose re-election, come back 4 years later and win it back.
Right. The conventional wisdom is that if you lose election after you've been in office, you're done for.
You're done. You go retire and that's the end of your political career. But Grover came back. Actually, he won the popular vote in that middle election in 1888, but lost the electoral vote. That'll never happen again. But I was always interested in Grover because of that. And what I found out researching the book is that he was really a remarkable politician, and he catapulted to the presidency probably faster and from greater obscurity than any other president. I mean, in 1880, nobody knew who Grover Cleveland was. He was a bachelor living in Buffalo, practicing law. And in 1881, he was elected mayor of Buffalo. He established a reputation as a good mayor, a man of integrity. He vetoed a lot of bills that would have been wasteful. The next year, in 1882, he was elected governor of New York. And then 2 years later, in 1884, he was nominated as the Democratic candidate for president and won the presidency. So he really went from nowhere to the presidency in a space of 4 years, a really remarkable achievement.
And he was, I mean, he was something of a long shot for governor of New York, let alone the presidency.
Yeah. His biographer, Alan Nevins, wrote a great biography of him back in the 30s. But Nevins says the stars were with him. And it seems every time he faced a major election, there was something going on that fell, you know, in his favor. In the 1880s especially, there was a great reform movement, and he kind of became the reform candidate in each of these elections. Then the non-reformists would run their own guy, it would split the vote a little bit, and then Cleveland would win. So he was very lucky, in addition to being a skillful politician.
And his reputation was as a pretty straight shooter, which we will find out was not without some irony.
Yeah, he became known as the Honest President. And that was his nickname, in fact. This goes back to his first campaign in 1884 when it came out that he had fathered an illegitimate child. And very famously, he sent a telegram back to his friends in Buffalo that said simply, "Tell the truth." This actually won him a lot of praise and a lot of votes in the end. It could have sabotaged his campaign, this revelation that he had fathered an illegitimate child. But his reaction to the revelation is what really earned him a reputation for honesty and integrity.
Well, so can you draw a parallel for us? What was the economic climate in the country as the president's health became a concern, or at least a concern for him?
Right. At the beginning of his second term in 1893, there were a lot of things going on in the country similar to what's going on now. For one thing, there was a speculative bubble. The bubble in 1893 was railroads. Railroads were hopelessly overbuilt in the 1880s and 1890s, and a lot of people had bought stock in railroads. But by 1893, the railroads had become so overbuilt that a lot of them started going bankrupt. 119 railroads went bankrupt in 1893 alone, and a lot of people had stock in those railroads. That stock was now worthless, and that brought down the stock market. Another thing that was going on that was interesting, there was a big debate about whether our money should be backed by gold or silver. It seems kind of arcane today when our money is backed by nothing.
Promises.
But, yes, exactly. The good faith of the government. But back then it was backed by gold. But as Western states came into the nation, these were big silver mining states, Montana, Idaho, Nevada. And as they came into the Union, they started clamoring for silver to also be a basis for the currency. So that was a big political debate. Really the biggest political debate between the Civil War and the First World War was gold versus silver. What should our money be based on? And it's funny, today it just seems so, it does seem so arcane to us. But back then, it was really one of the most divisive issues because it divided the regions, really. The West and the South wanted silver, and the East and the North wanted gold. And so it really drew lines along regional lines.
And so what do we know about when the president first started having medical concerns?
It was really just a few weeks after his inauguration. Back then, the inaugurations were March 4th, 1893. So it was probably around April that he noticed a little rough spot on the roof of his mouth. It was on the upper left side, a little bump near his molars. He had a lot going on at the time. As we talked about, the economic situation was very precarious. His wife at the time was pregnant as well, so he had some personal concerns.
And he had a very young wife.
He did, actually. He married in 1886 during his first term when she was 21. Frances Cleveland was 21 and he was 49. So he had a young wife who was expecting their second child. So when he noticed this thing on the roof of his mouth, he really didn't think much of it, and he put it off. And it wasn't until May that finally his family doctor, a guy named Joseph Bryant, examined it. Bryant actually had some expertise in oral cancer. And as soon as he looked at it, he called it a bad-looking tenant and said it should be removed right away.
And this came not too long after a former president, Ulysses S. Grant, had a similar situation.
Back it was 1887, 1888, I believe, Ulysses S. Grant had died of an oral cancer. And this was a very public spectacle, the death of Grant, one of the first great public deaths in American history, I guess you could say. Cleveland had lived through that. In fact, he was president when Grant died, and he didn't like the idea of becoming the object of a spectacle like that.
So there are a couple of things that were going on that may seem foreign to people who are presidential observers today, one of which is the attitude that people had towards cancer in those days. This is not something that was really talked about much.
Right. I think it's interesting that when Bryant, Cleveland's doctor, diagnosed the tumor, he just called it a bad-looking tenant. And the word cancer probably was never even said in front of Grover Cleveland. At the time, cancer was a stigma. Newspapers wouldn't use the word. It would be the dread disease or the disease that no doctor dare name. Those are the kinds of euphemisms that were employed. They always found a good way to explain the disease without saying the word cancer. They would refer to it as the disease that General Grant faced with such great pathos, things like that, anything but cancer.
We live in an era in which the president's annual physical exam is news. What did people typically know about the health of the chief executive in the 19th century? I mean, we think about Ronald Reagan having polyp surgery, even if in those days didn't even really talk much about cancer. We at least knew that was going on. What did people know about the health of their presidents in those days?
Not much, although there were rumors about the president's health even in the 19th century. Lincoln contracted smallpox shortly after giving the Gettysburg Address, and it was the most virulent strain of smallpox, although his aides dismissed it as a very light case. Closer to Grover Cleveland's time, Chester Arthur had a disease called Bright's disease, a kidney disease that he also denied having, but he died. He did not run for re-election in 1884 and then ended up dying like a year later. So there were rumors about the health of the presidents even in the 19th century, but people really didn't know that much about the health of their presidents.
Well, you mentioned the president's personal physician. Tell us about the team that was then assembled and what their strategy wound up being.
Right. So Cleveland is diagnosed with the cancerous tumor on the roof of his mouth. This would be sometime probably late May, early June of 1893. So he will acquiesce to its removal only if the operation is kept secret. So they decided to do the operation on a friend's boat, a yacht that Cleveland frequently was a guest on, so it wouldn't raise a lot of suspicion. And Bryant, his personal physician, recruited five other doctors. They were really the cream of the crop of American surgery at the time. One of them was a doctor from Philadelphia named Keene, who had performed the first successful removal of a brain tumor. So these were really the best doctors in America. They were recruited to perform this secret operation to remove the tumor from Cleveland on a yacht sailing from New York to Cape Cod. That they agreed to do it shows a little bit of ego, but it was also a pretty foolhardy mission to accept. It was a very dangerous operation.
And there's a discussion about whether he would use anesthesia, and if so, what sort?
Right. The operation was performed in a little saloon underneath the deck of the yacht. The best anesthesia available at that time was ether, but ether is very combustible, and so there were fears. They had a small electric light attached to a portable battery. That was their only light for the operation. In such a confined space, there were fears that ether, because it's so combustible, would explode or something. So they really wanted to do the operation on laughing gas, nitrous oxide. And so they started the operation by putting the president under nitrous oxide. But in about 15 minutes, he began to regain sensation. They realized that they would have to do the operation under ether, which was much more dangerous.
In the end, it sounds like the operation, say what you want about the secrecy and the location, it sounds like it went about as well as it could have gone.
It's kind of incredible, really. And I talked to a couple pathologists about this, and even today, contemporary modern pathologists are kind of amazed at the success of this operation. The tumor was completely removed, along with a lot of his upper palate, upper left palate, and a piece of his upper left jaw. Five teeth were removed as well. It's called varicose carcinoma, VC. It's a malignant form of cancer, but it doesn't metastasize. And so that's why Cleveland had no recurrence of the disease for the rest of his life. But the treatment that he got is the same treatment that people get today. You have to excise the tumor. That's the only treatment. And if you don't excise the tumor, it can actually grow so large that it can obstruct your breathing and your eating and eventually can kill you. So, yeah, he was lucky. He had the kind of tumor that actually could be completely removed.
So they kept the operation a secret. At the same time, the presidency is a pretty visible position. So how were they able to stave off any media attention in the amount of time that it would take a president to anybody to recuperate from an operation like this?
Well, cover story was he was going up to his summer home on Cape Cod. It's on Buzzards Bay, a place called Gray Gables, to do some fishing. After the operation, it took 4 days. They left New York July 1st. They landed at Gray Gables on July 5th. The president healed remarkably quickly. He was fitted with a prosthesis, a piece of hard vulcanized rubber that he would pop up into his upper palate, and that would replace the tissue that was removed. It would restore the shape of his face and his speaking voice. And so it was only about 3 weeks that they kind of had to keep him from saying anything, although in that time he would go out fishing and the reporters would see him out on the boat. And there were rumors that he was ill, but it was all dismissed that the president had had a tooth extracted, and that was the only problem with him. And really in about 4 to 6 weeks, he was back to normal. One of his first public appearances was before a group of doctors, and nobody could detect anything amiss. And so it really was a very successful cover-up.
Well, and maybe it's an obvious point, but why was secrecy such an objective in this case?
Two things, really. One, because the economy was so bad, Cleveland feared that if it came known he had cancer, that the stock markets would crash. He was in favor of the gold standard, squarely. His vice president was not. His vice president was a silver guy, completely opposite sides of this issue, but they put them together to balance the ticket. He was also an intensely private guy, and he hated the idea of being the center of some kind of spectacle.
Well, and early in his career, he seemed to have a fairly friendly relationship with the press, but what was the relationship with the press at this stage of his presidency? And at the same time, how did the word trickle out?
He had a very rocky relationship with the press, and it went back to his first campaign for president in 1884 when a Buffalo newspaper printed the allegation that he had fathered an illegitimate child, and he felt really betrayed by Buffalo and by his friends in the Buffalo newspaper business particularly. So he always kept reporters at an arm's length. One of the dentists had missed an appointment because he was taking part in the Cleveland operation, and so he explained to the doctor who he was supposed to meet for this appointment, well, actually I had to do some work on the president of the United States, and he thought that was a pretty good excuse. And then slowly word began to filter out, especially among doctors in the New York area. The rumor started going around that Cleveland had had a tumor removed from his mouth. And one of these doctors eventually told a reporter in New York, a guy named E.J. Edwards, who worked for the Philadelphia Press. And it was Edwards who went back to this dentist named Hasbrook. And he kind of pretended to Hasbrook that he knew more about the story than he did. And Hasbrook said, oh, well, somebody on the boat must have told you that, and proceeded to tell him the whole story about what happened on the boat. And that was how the story eventually got into the papers. That was in late August of 93. So it was almost 2 months after the operation.
So Edwards has this amazing scoop. The Philadelphia Press runs the story. And you would think this is an enormous success. The world will be rocked by this. That does not prove to be the case.
No, the Cleveland administration denied that any such operation had taken place. They insisted continuously still that it was nothing more than a toothache. Edwards was really discredited. It was called a disgrace to journalism, a panic mongerer, a cancer faker. He really suffered because of this scoop. It should have been a triumph for him in his career, and it really turned out to be a black cloud that hung over his career for the rest of his life, almost.
When does his vindication come?
It wasn't until 1917, 24 years after the operation, that one of the doctors, the doctor named Keene from Philadelphia, a good Baptist guy, he always felt bad about the way Edwards had been treated. He asked Cleveland's widow, Frances, if it would be all right for him to publish an account of the operation. By then, Cleveland was dead. So was just about everybody else involved in the operation. And so he published a story in the Saturday Evening Post.
Respected medical journal,
yes,
that is.
Of all places. But he published a long article in the Saturday Evening Post, and he did this, he said, in part to vindicate Edwards, the reporter who had been so vilified by Cleveland and his allies. And so it wasn't until then, in 1917, that the story finally came out. And so it's taken a long time to sort of fill in the blanks that still existed in this story.
One of the interesting sidebars to this is that the tumor still exists, and you have seen this tumor.
Yes. The doctors who removed the tumor from Cleveland saved it, and they put it in a small jar with a preserving fluid, and later it was donated to a museum in Philadelphia called the Mutter Museum. It's a medical history museum, and you can actually go and see the tumor today. It's still there in the jar. The Cleveland children were always reluctant to have that specimen submitted for pathological testing because there were rumors that Cleveland had syphilis. And so they were afraid any pathological examination would determine whether or not he had had the venereal disease. Finally, in the late 1970s, they agreed to have the specimen tested. In 1980, finally, the results were published that he had this cancer, varicose carcinoma VC, a very rare type of malignant cancer.
So what does this tumor look like?
Like a piece of limp cauliflower, it looks like. There's a picture of it in the book. You can see a couple of teeth there with gold fillings, naturally. I talked to one of the doctors who actually did the pathological examination back in the late 70s, and he's now a very acclaimed pathologist himself, John Brooks in Philadelphia. And yes, he talked about how amazed he was by the operation. He also mentioned that this kind of cancer was so rare that he'd only seen one or two other cases besides Cleveland's in his whole career. And he's probably the only doctor in America who still has case notes on Grover Cleveland in his office, which was kind of cool. It continues to amaze doctors even today that this operation was carried out the way it was and that it was successful.
Matthew Algio, it's a fascinating corner of history. Thanks for sharing with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Matthew Algio is the author of The President is a Sick Man, wherein the supposedly virtuous Grover Cleveland survives a secret surgery at sea and vilifies the courageous newspaper man who dared expose the truth, published by Chicago Review Press. Algio is also a public radio producer who occasionally anchors NPR newscasts. He spoke with Mitch Teich before a recent reading at Boswell Book Company. Coming up next, Lake Effect's gardening contributor Melinda Myers talks about the benefits and basics of growing your own food. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM.